The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today we're joined by Dominic DiMaggio. He's a 9/11 researcher who has focused a lot of his efforts on Shanksville. We'll be getting into some of that today and learning more about him. So Dominic, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on here.
So this is an area that's outside of AE's focus. AE is not getting into Shanksville, but we're just focusing a little bit on it here today because I'm interested in hearing what everyone's got to say on the reasonable parts of this entire issue. So that's why we're giving Dominic some airtime this week. So Dominic, before we get into all that, tell us about your background and how did you wake up to 9/11 overall and the fact that we've been lied to so much about that day?
What happened was I started to hear the conspiracy theories online, and actually, they kind of upset me. And my thought was that I was going to drive out to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and track down witnesses whose names I'd read in newspapers or saw on television and interview them on film and actually debunk 9/11 conspiracies. And that was actually my first thought. And as I went down there and met people, I quickly jumped the fence on that and decided that everything the government had told me was a lie, which actually made me dig further into this, almost to the point where it became an obsession to try to understand exactly what happened there. Like, I had to take everything I knew and throw it all away, and like an investigator going to investigate something, just come in with a blank sheet and take these accounts from the witnesses that I contacted and put the puzzle together and come up ultimately with a picture, which the one thing I will say is what I am going to explain is what happened in maybe a 6 to 8 minute period of time over a small geographical area. And it's going to leave other questions, like if what I am saying is true, then what about this and what about that and what about this? And I can't answer those questions because I can only focus on this small area with the witnesses that surrounded it. You know what I'm saying?
Right. That's how research is done, though. I mean, because we face this with what we do at AE 9/11 Truth. It's like, okay, you know, the evidence shows there were explosives, but who did it? How did they get it in there? Why? I mean, those are very good questions, things that we would love to have answered, but unfortunately, all we can do is point to what we see, and this is how you capture history, this is how you do investigation. You talk to the eyewitnesses, and what they have to say is strikingly different than what all the newspapers have claimed. You make a note of it, and you just put out what you have, and then let the public try to vet it and determine how that jives with the official narrative or if it doesn't, and question what they've been told, possibly, if it makes more sense or if your source is more reliable. Now, I just want to highlight for the audience, you actually went out there to the scene, you talked to people who were there, and that's where your research is coming. So you're not just sitting around watching YouTube and reporting back what you found there. You were actually doing the real investigative work. So why don't you just lay it out? Tell us in story form here about coming upon the scene, what you did first, and some of the stuff that you heard.
I assembled a list of names that I could from the media, and I started looking up like who owned property, who did this, to find out addresses, to try to find these witnesses to go down and contact them. Some of the initial ones that I had contacted had agreed to talk to me, and then when I showed up, they were like, I'm not doing this. And what happened the first time, I got lucky. One of the people I didn't contact, but whose address and name I had was a woman named Susan McElwain. And I just randomly showed up at this woman's house one day, knocked on her door. She had no idea I was coming. Her husband opened the door, and I'm like, sir, I don't know how to do this, but like I kind of read about, you know, 9/11 on the internet, and I was wondering if this is a McElwain residence and if Susan was here, if I'd be able to talk to her and that. And he was like, yeah, okay, hold on. He goes and he gets his wife. She comes, and just nicest people you could ever imagine were just willing to take time out of their day for a random stranger who showed up at their house and asked them, like, hey, I read your name in the newspaper. Can you tell me what you saw on 9/11? And she was more than willing. The one thing that first stuck with me, and this is something that happened again and again and again with a lot of witnesses that I contacted, was Susan told me, you know, it's always someone like me and not a family member who calls or emails or just randomly showed up at her house. And she's like, she said it always troubled her that, like, she had this story of she describes a little white plane. And she was like, if I had a family member on Flight 93 and there was a witness out there who saw like a little white plane at the same time, I would kind of like want to talk to them and get more out of them, like, especially if, you know, the FBI or whatever is giving me a runaround on this. So Susan took me to the site where she was that day, and she described how she was driving down the road in her van and how this little white plane came zipping right over the top of her van and right over this tree line, and it disappeared out of her sight. And then moments later, there was an explosion, which she didn't see. And this was something that bothered me, because the direction she was traveling on the road, Flight 93 should have been coming almost straight towards her. Like, she should look up in the sky and be like, wow, there's a giant 757, but she doesn't see a 757. All she saw was the white plane and then this explosion. So from her being the first person I talked to, I tried piecing this together. And obviously with that kind of information, you're not going to figure out exactly what transpired. So I got more names, and I contacted more people, and I talked to people who worked at the salt mill that's up there by the place, a guy named Rick Cheney. I talked to Viola Saylor. I talked to Lee Purbaugh, the guy who was supposed to be the witness that actually saw a 757 impact the ground, the only one who would have been in a position to see it at the scrapyard. I talked to Tim and Nina Lenzbauer, Paul Muro. I mean, the list goes on and on. I have a list. And the story that starts to come out in the end was, let me not jump there yet. So let me say that I talked to a bunch of witnesses, and I went from I was still on the belief that Flight 93 had been engaged by the military and crashed in that field. I believe that there was hijackers on the plane, and I believe there was 44 passengers. That all changed after the late Lieutenant Colonel Sheldon, Langford. I'm messing up his last name. I feel so bad. Great man. He made an arrangement for us to meet with the coroner, Wally Miller. And when I met with the coroner, Wally Miller, is when all my thoughts on 9/11 changed that day. I sat in the coroner's office. I interviewed him. The video was online for a long time. I did a radio show, I think, in 2018. And after that appearance, a lot of my interviews have been wiped from the net. I think you could still find a couple clips on YouTube, but that's probably about it. The full interviews themselves have been deleted and everything else, because after Wally Miller interviewed me, he was contacted and told that he's no longer allowed to give interviews to anybody. And there's many reasons for this, because there was many contradictions in Wally Miller's account, and there were things that I got Wally Miller to talk about that really make you question whether or not a plane had crashed there and people had actually died there. And when I was in the coroner's office, one of the things was I got to go through the coroner's photographs, and you could actually see it on video. He didn't let me film any of the photographs. I wanted to. I thought they should be in the public domain. It seems like that's, you know, that's something that would belong to the public. And I went through, he brought me in a shoebox. I can't tell you how many photos there were. Well over a thousand images had to be. We were just picking up, like, I mean, as many as you could hold in your hand. And there was like four of us in a room with like handfuls, just go through them and then you hand it to the next guy, go through like that. And as I went through all these images of Wally Miller's from the crash site, the things that stuck out to me the most was that, one, I wasn't seeing any pictures of any human remains, and two, I wasn't seeing any pictures of something you would expect, a landing gear maybe, or a seat, something still intact that shows, you know, like there was a plane here, not just tiny pieces of scrap metal. I mean, nothing big, nothing that you could look at and be like, oh, that's a fuselage piece from an airplane. That's, look at that. That thing's got to be like 7 foot by like 6 foot. You know what I mean? And then I asked Wally about this crater. And I'm pressing him on the size of the crater, because that's something that was always in dispute. And we're talking about a 757. And Wally doesn't want to give any kind of specs on what size he thinks this crater is. And I'm like, well, would you say it's, I don't know, 6 or 8 feet deep? And he's like, sure. And I'm like, what, maybe 10 or 12 feet wide? He's like, yeah, sure. Like, he doesn't want to put any kind of thing on it to stress that this crater is, I mean, real small. It is tiny. So I go through these photos, and what I find that looks like human remains is, and these troubled me more too, was a severed left arm. And this, I mean, you could tell it was a real human arm. You could see there were veins and all that. It's laying on, it's not in the grass, it's just laying out on the dirt. And so I began thinking, like, there was a quote from Wally Miller. And the other thing was, there were like two internal organs, like maybe something that looked like maybe a kidney or a liver or something like that. Also, not in the grass or anything like that, laying in the dirt. And it made me think of this quote Wally Miller had given to the New York Times, where he had said he'd been working the crash site for over a year and he'd never found a drop of blood on that crash site. And so I checked with him about that. I was like, I want to confirm, you told the New York Times that you didn't find any blood anywhere at this crash site. He's like, that is correct. He goes, there was human remains, there was no blood. And while I asked him that, I was thinking in my head this picture of this severed arm laying in the dirt. And the severed arm, it wasn't burnt, it wasn't charred, it wasn't, like, there should have been blood. There should have been blood. Like, if a human being's arm gets cut off and it flies 30, 40 feet somewhere and it lands, there's still blood in that arm that's going to come out, is the way I'm thinking. Same with these internal organs that I thought was like maybe a kidney or a liver or something like that, a lung, I'm not sure. But that was the appearance it had. Like, how could that be there with there being no blood? The rest of the human remain photographs were just tiny, tiny bone fragments. I mean, just chips of bone, like nothing. There wasn't even anything else I saw that had flesh on it. He talked about how they recovered hands and feet. I didn't see any pictures of that. At one point, I found a picture of a skull, and I asked him. I showed him the picture, and I said, there's a picture of a skull in this, or there's a skull in this photograph. I'm like, what is this? And he talked down to me all condescending, because I wanted to clarify what it was, and just to make sure. And he's like telling me how, you know, it's a model that they brought in to help identify bone fragments, so I better not go out on the internet and start telling people that Wally Miller recovered severed heads at this crash site, because that didn't happen. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's not where I was going. I just wanted, you know, an explanation to what this skull was. So I left Wally's office that day, and that was the day where I decided I had to take everything that I'd saw on TV, everything I'd read online, and throw it all away and just use the witnesses that I had started contacting and finding more witnesses to figure out what happened. Because in my mind, I didn't see enough human remains to account for two human beings, let alone 44 of them. So from there, and the witnesses that I talked to, I began, the conclusion I came to was, especially taking into account certain things like Let's Roll, the story of how the passengers fought back. And if you go to the memorial, there's a transcript of what's supposed to be a cockpit voice recorder, but no one's actually heard the recording, so we just have to trust the government that this really happened. And I don't know. And the thing that popped up to me was a place called Indian Lake. Now, Indian Lake is 3.5 miles the way the crow flies southeast of the crash site. If anyone listening right now, I would highly recommend you go to Google and you just type in Indian Lake. I'm doing it right now. Indian Lake, PA. You hit enter, hit the maps button, look at Indian Lake. You'll see Indian Lake is pretty much to the east, southeast of where the Flight 93 National Memorial site now is. That Flight 93 National Memorial site is where they say the plane crashed. It came out of the northwest. A lot of the witnesses I talked to, like Viola Saylor, Paul Muro, the truck drivers, God, I wish I had my list in front of me. I don't have their names. But they were all along like Lambertsville Road and Route 30. They were all north of this crash site. This is where they all saw Flight 93. It's all heading towards the National Memorial there. If the government is telling the truth about what happened to this plane and it crashed in this field, then Indian Lake can never, ever be a part of the story I'm telling. Unfortunately, you can find a lot of witnesses from Indian Lake. There's at the very southern part of the lake, there's a marina. Off to the right of it is a golf course. Off to the left of the marina is where the now deceased, the former mayor of Indian Lake, Barry Lichty, I believe, that was his house. They all, over at the marina, there was Tom Spinelli, Jim Brandt, John Flegel, Carol DeLasco. At the golf course, there's Chris Johnson, and then we have the mayor, Barry Lichty. We have these at least 5-6 names right here at the southern point of Indian Lake who talk about hearing or seeing Flight 93 fly over. There's if Flight 93 flies over any part of Indian Lake, everything about the official government story is false. Now, this doesn't mean that the plane wasn't shot down. This doesn't mean there wasn't hijackers. This doesn't mean there isn't a crash site somewhere else. This does mean that this plane didn't crash in this field here. So if this plane doesn't crash in this field here, what happened in the field becomes the next question. When I said at the beginning, there's a lot of questions I can't answer. All I can talk about is a small period of time. This small period of time right here over this field is the only thing I can tell you about. Now, what happened on the morning of September 11th, 2001, between, I would say, 9:58 a.m. and 10:06 a.m. is the following. Out of the northwest a large commercial jet appears. It's flying just above the tree lines. This is reported by Viola Saylor. It's confirmed by Paul Muro, a guy who lives very close to the crash site. M-U-R-O is the spelling of his last name. When he sees the plane, he says it's flying normal. It's upside. It's not upside down. It's the right side up. It's just above the trees. And then, you know, perspective, topography of the land and all that. Low-flying plane goes so far, the trees obscure your view as to what happens to it. It's out of sight. So they see the plane all head in that direction. But then again, we have the witnesses at Indian Lake who also see the plane, or Barry Litchty in Loose Change, Final Cut. You can actually go watch the interview. The mayor of Indian Lake not only talks about something comes flying over his house at screaming over. He says it almost sounds like a missile. He also confirms to Dylan Avery that it's coming from the direction of the crash site. It's not heading that way. It's coming from that way. So what happens in the field? Well, that takes us back to Susan McElwain. Susan McElwain pulled up to that intersection, and she didn't see Flight 93 nosediving out of the sky the way the official story, you know, claims it should be. And why didn't she? Because by the time she gets to that intersection, Flight 93 is already over Indian Lake and on its way to New Baltimore, Pennsylvania, which is another 5 miles southeast. Susan sees this little white plane that goes up and disappears behind the tree line. And then she sees the explosion. And she goes home and calls 911 and reports seeing a small plane crash. Now, there are some other witnesses I have talked to who I've never released their names. So everyone listening right now has to make a choice on if they decide that what I'm saying so far is credible or not as to the rest of my story, because there are people who only told me things under the promise that I wouldn't identify. Like, I'll tell you this, but I don't want my name out there because I wanted to find out. I needed to know what happened. One woman wouldn't tell me. Her husband had passed away. She said, my husband saw everything, but he's not alive now to tell you his story, and I'm not going to tell it to you, but I will tell you mine. And she told me that she was inside of her house. She heard the explosion, felt the ground rumble, and she ran out onto her porch to see what had happened outside, and her husband was sitting there, and he pointed over, and she looked, and she saw this little white plane. And she's like, this little white plane was doing circles just above the trees. She's like, and then I could see the smoke start to rise up from underneath of the plane, and then it flew off. And then I had other witnesses, Viola, who came back outside after the explosion. She talked about how the Flight 90, she was in her backyard. She said she saw Flight 93 fly over, and then she went into her house. And then it was an explosion, and then she came outside. Now, to put that into perspective, Viola Saylor at the time was probably in her mid-60s, maybe, something like that. I'm not sure if she's still alive. I hope she is. If not, God rest that woman's soul. She was. I met and talked to her twice. She was an amazing woman. There's interview footage online. But she said the plane flew over, and she went inside, and then there was an explosion, and then she came back outside, and then she saw the little white plane fly, like, passed over her, like heading north, like she said, towards Jennerstown. So we had this plane approach the crash site, the little white one, from the south, reported by Susan McElwain. And then we have the explosion. I have a witness. I actually have two, the woman and her neighbor, who confirmed the woman's account. She saw the same thing. Reports seeing this, they're off to the west of the crash site, seeing this little white plane circle around above the trees, right above the tree line, before the smoke is rising up. Like, that's, it's there. Like, there, I have three witnesses, Susan McElwain, these other two women, their names are actually with the attorneys or lawyers for 9/11 Truth. I gave them all the names. They have them all. We're trying to get the FBI interviewed all these people. We're trying to get these documents. But the plane approaches, there's the explosion, it's circling around, the smoke is now starting to rise up, the plane flies off, and there's Viola Saylor who watches it fly away, confirming what all these witnesses saw. So to kind of summarize that quickly, it seems like on the morning of September 11th, the government completely staged a crash site. They had a low-flying commercial airliner come in maybe 100 feet off the ground just above the trees. It flies over Flight 93 where the memorial site is now. It flies over the southern tip of Indian Lake. It begins to gain altitude. Pilots for 9/11 Truth had they had got documents where they turned the transponder back on over Indian Lake. It actually gives coordinates. It goes past Indian Lake. It goes past New Baltimore. That's the direction this commercial airliner flies. Then this little white plane comes up. The explosion happens. I don't know how, because no one's like, I saw it shoot a missile into the ground, or I saw this, or I saw that. All I know is the plane approaches. There's an explosion there. It isn't the plane, because the plane is still there, and the little white plane flies away. I go to the coroner's office. I go through thousands of photographs looking for images of human remains, and I come out unsatisfied. If those images are available to all of you, which I hope in time they're going to be, they should be. It should be a public domain. It's a coroner. It's a crime scene. That should be something the public can access. Let me reassure you that if you go through all the coroner's photos, you are not going to be satisfied that 44 human beings lost their life at this spot either.
Now, we've only got a few minutes left here. It's fascinating for me because I don't know a lot about this. I've heard the story about the little white plane. I might have even seen your video back in the day when I was first waking up to this around 06 or whatnot. I am looking at a picture of the crash site here in Shanksville. Now, I do see something. It's like, it's a white, I don't know if it's a tail or something there. There's little pieces of white metal, I would assume, that most people, lay people looking at this would presume was the airplane, but you do not see very much. It almost looks like it's a crater. It's a black spot in the ground. It looks like there's triangles sort of on the side, but it's very hard to see here. Now, I've seen pictures of other crash sites. It does look atypical. They claim that the thing was going straight down, but there are problems, of course, if people are giving an account of another airplane there and something went on. So I'm just basically putting it out there for the general public, and I think there's probably a lot more that you could say on this, but we are getting out of time. Do you have any final statements or thoughts?
I'll try to be as quick as possible because I tried to condense that. I know we only had 30 minutes. One of the things I will say is when Wally Miller gave his account of the plane crash, he gave a completely different account than the straight down nose diving 39 degree angle. Wally, the way he describes it, actually puts it coming in from the east, which again is not the official flight path, because he says it hits at like an angle and the cockpit breaks off of the plane and shatters into the woods, is what Wally Miller says. So when you see that debris, that's the other thing too to notice. The plane came out of the northwest. If you go look at those original crash photos and you get your geography right, the blast trajectory is west. It is heading west into those trees, which would tell you from physics that whatever impacted it had to come from the east because of the way the trees are damaged. So that's one thing I want to point out. Like, at the bare minimum, the damage from the trees being where it is and the direction it's going from a physics standpoint tells you that the official story that the government telling, regardless of my account, can't be true. It's just physics. How can a plane coming from the northwest go straight into the ground and blow everything, all the debris on a west pattern. It has to be coming out of the east to do that.
Now, Dominic, just in 20 seconds here, how can people follow up on this and learn more about your research? Is there any centralized place?
Like I said earlier, after my last interview, a lot of stuff had been taken down, but if you go on to maybe YouTube, and there's still stuff, if you put in maybe Shanksville 9/11 Truth, if you put in Susan McElwain, the last name is McElwain, or Viola Saylor, Saylor, or Wally Miller, you'll be able to find clips of these interviews. From there might be a video or two that I put together with some other witnesses like Rick Cheney or Lee Perbal, some interviews, audio interviews. I think those are still up on YouTube, so you should be able to find them on YouTube to dig a little deeper into this and hear some of these accounts yourself.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us today and coming on 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Have a great week. Good luck.